listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from the Central and South America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Okay, so let's start in Colombia with what happened over the weekend and what that might all mean.
As expected, the Duque, the right-wing presidential candidate in Colombia's election, won by a big margin, on a very low turnout, it has to be said. And I haven't seen the latest figures for the election results in Colombia's presidential election yesterday, but the results that I did see put the turnout at just over 44%, and that's quite ironic because the Colombian political leaders made great show of the fact that Venezuela's turnout in its presidential election just a couple of weeks ago, two or three weeks ago, was around 47%, and they said, well, that just shows how little legitimacy Nicolas Maduro has as president of Venezuela. So now Duque's been elected as the president of Colombia on a percentage of only 44%. But right, you won't hear him saying, you won't hear him questioning his own legitimacy, of course.
Right.
So what's the regional significance of that? Well, none of it is good, because looked at from a point of view of Nicaragua, Juan Manuel Santos, the current Colombian president, has been dragging his feet in his obligation to recognize the International Court of Justice decision to reinstate 90,000 square kilometers of maritime territory that Colombia had usurped for around 80, 90 years. And that decision was given back in 2013, I think. And although in practice the Colombian Navy seems to be respecting that decision, Juan Manuel Santos and the Colombian government have never recognized it. So from Nicaragua's point of view, and Álvaro Uribe, the extreme right-wing narco-terrorist ex-president, is the person who is regarded as the power behind the throne, as it were, for Duque, the new president.
Right.
So
yeah, that's where I wanted to go for a second, because this was the second round. They had the first round was last month, and you had Duque and Petro, the top two vote getters at that time, and with pretty small pieces of the vote, by the way. Want to talk about margins. It was 13% turnout, I think, in the first round. It was 53% turnout in the first round, and he got 13% of that. That was Duque, the winner. And the second place person got like 33, a third of a percent, I think, or something, like a really low number. And then, so you have Duque representing more or less, I mean, you've got the FARC people, and then the soft left, and then Santos, and then Uribe at the hard right, and so Duque is more or less representing the Uribe trend in the politics.
Yeah, absolutely, the extreme right wing, and to the right of Juan Manuel Santos.
Okay? Right. Okay, and then Petro sort of representing Juan Manuel Santos trend. Is that kind of true?
Yeah, and basically Duque is a representative of Uribe's paramilitary base, and that's the political base of Álvaro Uribe, and the paramilitaries, and I think we've said this before, Colombia has something like, I don't know, 1,100 or 1,200 municipalities, and the paramilitaries control around 250 of those, something like that. And so in any election, in any election, the extreme right wing already have a built-in advantage because their paramilitaries intimidate people into voting for the candidate, for Uribe's candidate.
Or into not voting in those areas. Because we're looking again, you're talking about turnout. The population in 2016 of Colombia was just shy of 50 million, like 48.65 million or something.
Right.
The total turnout yesterday was shy of 20 million. And Duque, the winner, had 10,373,000 votes on, out of almost 50 million. So, that's like 5%. Some mandate.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what the percentage of the electorate is.
Well, 5% of the population, so figure maybe that's 10% of the electorate. If half the people are not eligible to vote, then there should have been 25 million people voting yesterday, and he got 10 million votes. It's not even half.
Right. I think the Colombian electorate is around 30 million, the people entitled to vote.
Okay.
As I say, I haven't seen the final figure, but the figures that for participation that I did see put the turnout of at around 44% of eligible voters. Anyway, and when we talk about these elections, it's easy to fall into the trap of treating them as though they are somehow democratic. But and of course, there are all kinds of factors that militate against any free and fair elections in Colombia or anywhere else, really, but particularly in Colombia. Even taking that system, let's pretend it's democratic for a minute. And what happened in the first round was that Petro got something like 26-27% of the vote, but surprisingly, another social democrat style candidate, Sergio Fajardo, more centre right perhaps than Gustavo Petro, he got 20%. Now, and everybody thought immediately after that first round that Sergio Fajardo would validate Gustavo Petro, but instead of doing that, he said he'd abstained. He told his people to abstain. Now, if you look at that, that's just yet another example of a social democrat style politician holding the door open for the right.
Right.
And so if they'd combined. if Sergio Fajardo and Petro had combined, they'd have wiped out Duque. Because their combined vote would have been between 45% and 50% of the vote,
right?
Without taking into account the independents. They would have won hands down if Fajardo and Petro had united. But anyway, and that's what happened. So, and going back to the consequences for the consequences internally for Colombia are not good, because Duque represents the most recalcitrant reactionary elements in Colombia's oligarchic elite.
Well, I'm thinking about his relationship to Uribe, at least ideologically, and what that means for the peace, situation.
You can probably kiss goodbye to a satisfactory outcome for the peace protest, because and Duque, although in the campaign he made nicey-nice and said that he wanted to reform the peace process, and that's not true. He and Uribe want to kill it. You know, they want to lock up all the FARC members that negotiated in good faith.
Right, who have disarmed, by the way.
Yeah, so, you know, and they disarmed in good faith. Juan Manuel Santos and the Colombian state failed to comply with their side of the agreement, foot-dragging on almost every point. And engaging in judicial harassment of FARC leaders, failing to comply with the rural provisions for agricultural reform that would have benefited all rural families in Colombia, not just the members of the FARC. But I know a whole series of agreements that they've reneged on, in effect. And although they would say that they couldn't overcome the institutional obstacles in Colombia's system, but you know, the legislature, the judiciary. But if they'd been the political will, they could have implemented the agreement. But there was never the political will, and all of us who were sceptical to begin with and fearful to begin with, in that regard, have been proved right. Yeah. I know I'm not happy to say that. But and even economically, and that's bad news for people in Colombia, because Duque is just going to deepen the ridiculous neoliberal system that has impoverished so many people in Colombia. I don't know the exact figures, but the poverty figures for Colombia are extremely high, in terms of region.
Right.
And Colombia is the most unequal country in a very unequal continent.
Right.
So, and domestically, it's all bad news. And on the foreign affairs front, as I was saying, from Nicaragua's point of view, it's bad news because Duque will probably be more aggressive about failing to implement the International Court of Justice decision. So there'll probably be more conflict on that front. Mm. But more importantly for the region, it's very bad news for Venezuela, because Venezuela is now faced with a president in Colombia who's totally committed to implementing U.S. policy, the most aggressive U.S. policy in the region against Venezuela.
Right.
It's also will that mean some kind of military intervention along the Venezuelan-Colombian border? It might well do. We'll see. You never know when extreme right-wingers are voted into power, because sometimes they moderate their rhetoric once they get into office. But I fear that's not going to be the case with Duque, because he's such a creature of Álvaro Uribe.
Right.
We'll see. And then in broader regional terms, the election of Duque also very badly threatens the integration processes. For example, the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR, and the group of Latin American and Caribbean states, the community of Latin American and Caribbean states, CELAC. And most of the right wing elites in Latin America support CELAC because it's a good forum for negotiating directly with China and other world players like the Russian Federation and the European Union. For example, the European Union and CELAC have been holding, I'm not sure if they're annual or biannual conferences, And that's very useful from the point of view of the Latin American elites, because that gives them a better forum to negotiate from than bilateral agreements with individual countries. But and certainly in terms of UNASUR, and it's not good news for UNASUR, because Colombia is one of the countries that said it would withdraw from UNASUR a couple of months ago. So Duque is likely to implement that seriously. Then, you know, it's just bad news all around for any progressive agenda in the region.
Yeah, and also, right, for the region. I mean, one of the things, just looking at a map, one of the things that you notice, in big letters, Colombia is the contact point between Central America and South America. So it's not, in terms of physical integration, in terms of movement of goods and people and services back and forth, it mediates it physically.
Yeah.
You know, so,
and
so,
yeah, and the Colombian business interests have been expanding their investments in Central America, and they got a very helpful bridgehead in Honduras as a result of the 2009 coup against President Mel Zelaya.
Right.
And they along with Israel gave very substantial security support to the coup regime in 2009. Mm. And from Honduras, and they've also been expanding into Guatemala. I don't know about El Salvador, but they've definitely been expanding into Nicaragua, and that's one of the kind of contradictions for the right wing here in Nicaragua. The right wing business interests are against Daniel Ortega. They want to overthrow the government of President Ortega. But they're concerned that the much wealthier Colombian business interests are going to displace them in that process. So, you know, maybe we can talk a bit more about that if we have time to talk about Nicaragua. But the thing about Colombia is that its economy has shifted more and more away from the kind of productive economy that promotes genuine economic prosperity to the kind of financialized economy that you have in the United States, where and all that generates is a tendency to increasing poverty and a definite tendency towards increasing inequality.
Right.
So that's what's happening in Colombia, and you know, and that was reflected in the turnout. The very low turnout reflects the fact that the impoverished majority see no point in trying to engage in electoral politics because it's never done them any good. And their interests are always shoved to the margins.
Yeah, the only thing that changes after, you know, going out and busting your behind all day is the numbers on somebody's ledger, as opposed to, well, we produced 18 more mangoes and a Buick or whatever. There's no actual physical activity going on in the economy. It's all financialized nonsense.
Yeah, and you can see that in Argentina. And we right from the start, when Mauricio Macri's right-wing government was elected back in November 2015, you and I have been insisting that sooner rather than later, the Argentinian economy is going to implode because the neoliberal model that Macri and his team want to impose benefit mainly foreign investors and foreign finance interests and do not do anything for Argentine's real productive economy.
Right.
And that's exactly what's happened. Macri, after a year of somewhat incoherent economic policy, made it very clear that he was banking on foreign investment to reactivate Argentina's productive economy. That didn't happen, and as a result, obviously, he had to resort to debt.
Right.
Now he's resorted to substantial foreign debt. The dollar's taken off in terms of its value against the Argentine peso in Argentina. Now the productive economy that works in pesos can't generate enough money to pay the foreign debt denominated in dollars. So as a result, there's a balance of payments crisis. what happens in a balance of payments crisis? The government goes running to the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. Right. The International Monetary Fund imposes absurd austerity measures, and that's exactly what's happening in Argentina.
Yep.
So the IMF is now effectively in charge of Argentina's economic policy.
I mean, what ends up happening again is an incremental conveyance of the title to the productive economy to finance sector. That's happens. And all the rest of it is, you know, is circus. But what ends up happening is you have these two different financial regimes, two different currency regimes or whatever. One sets the rules for both. The crisis is created in the process, and the solution is imposed by the one that precipitated the crisis or imposed the crisis in the first place, well, who ends up representing the beneficiaries of the transfer of wealth of the subject nation state or other entity.
Yeah, and I might, the one of the few economists worth reading is Michael Hudson, very experienced, well-known U.S. economist.
Yep.
And he writes about what he calls the toll booth economy.
Yep.
You know, everything, you know, even fresh air eventually, and gets some financialized so that ordinary people have to pay the banks.
Right.
For what should be basic rights, you know, right. Whether it's from whether it's public roads, public education, the health system, everything gets financialized, and that's you can see that whole process is happening in Argentina.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so, they did it once before, and we saw where it led.
Yeah,
I mean, they actually did it several times before, and each time it led that way, and that's what we said was going to happen when Macri got elected back in December. What was it 2015 or whatever? And sure as hell, here we are.
Yeah, and you don't need to be not clairvoyant.
Right, exactly.
It's just two and two equals four, you know?
Here comes a bus. It's storming down the road. I'm going to step into the lane at the last minute. Gee, I wonder what will happen. Do I need a crystal ball?
Right. See, what else has been going on? Well, more on a more positive note, in Bolivia, Evo Morales will very shortly be making a visit to China, which is of great significance for the Andean region, because Bolivia is the most successful economy in terms of many indicators. And if Evo Morales and his government can consolidate an even more successful relationship with China than they already have, that would be very good news for the overall region, for the Andean economy.
Yep.
And that's reflected, you know, you'd expect the right-wing governments of Peru, the right-wing government, or the center-right government that has now taken hold in Ecuador under Lenin Moreno, the right-wing government under Chile, the right-wing government in Paraguay, the right-wing usurper government under Michel Temer in Brazil. You'd expect them all to be quite hostile to Bolivia, but they're not.
Right.
At least not on the surface.
Right.
And they recently had, I think, what was it, the 23rd, or I've forgotten the number now, but they recently had the South American Games, the kind of a subset of the Olympic Games for South America.
Right.
And that went off very, very successfully in Bolivia, and a very successful event in terms of public relations for the Bolivian government within the region.
Mm.
And much more importantly, Bolivia recently had a meeting, I think it was Peru, Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay took part in a meeting with Bolivia about the Chinese-funded transcontinental railway, which is projected to cost about $10 billion, and maybe, if not more, and it's always, all these estimates turn out being underestimates, don't they?
Of course.
For these massive mega projects. So that's a transcontinental railway running from the port of Ilo on the southern Pacific coast of Peru, running through Bolivia, Paraguay, into Brazil, and reaching the Atlantic at the Brazilian port of Santos, which is just north of Uruguay. So Uruguay, Brazil, Paraguay, and Peru met with Bolivia recently, agreed various details that needed to be settled before the project could go ahead. All those details seem to have been agreed without difficulty. So that project is, it looks as though it's going to go ahead. And that's very, very positive for South America.
Yeah. Yeah, Transcontinental Railroad. It'll do wonders. Ask the people of California.
Right.
Yeah.
So then, by contrast, here in Nicaragua, it's very clear that one of the reasons that the United States government and the United States elites, represented by various interests, they're continuing with their efforts to overthrow the Sandinista government of President Ortega. And I wrote a piece about this today that's out on Telesur, in which I explain, or I argue, that what's happening here in Nicaragua is just the latest phase of a long permanent war by the United States against any progressive force that raises its head above the parapet here in Latin America and the Caribbean. Wow. And so, and it's very much part of the decades-long ongoing war against Cuba, the continuing campaign against the government of the Bolivarian government, currently of Nicolas Maduro, but previously of President Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And eventually, they'll get to work trying to destabilize in a more aggressive way the government of Evo Morales in Bolivia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's behind the overthrow of Dilma Rousseff and the imprisonment of Lula da Silva in Brazil.
Right.
And so, and that's what the crisis in Nicaragua is all about. And if you look at what's happening here, it's very clear that the United States has learned from its experience supporting fascist movements elsewhere in the world, and terrorist movements elsewhere in the world, for example, especially in the Ukraine, but also in Libya and more recently Syria.
Yeah.
And they support terrorism to intimidate the population, to make it harder for the legitimate government to consolidate coherent support around its political program.
Yeah.
And then when their terrorist elements manage to force the government into any kind of negotiation, they apply the same process that they've used in the Minsk agreement in Ukraine, whereby they'll kind of reach an agreement, but they'll fail to implement the agreement. They'll systematically right. fail to implement the agreement.
That's right.
But in the process, for every failure of the agreement, they'll blame the other side that's actually behaving in good faith.
Right.
And that is what is happening here in Nicaragua now. Because if you remember in our previous conversations, I described how there's a national dialogue process happening here in Nicaragua,
right.
supposedly mediated by the Nicaraguan bishops.
Mm.
Now, that's been a stop-start process. The bishops suspended it about 2.5-3 weeks ago because the government wouldn't agree to the way the bishops were handling it.
Yeah.
And now it restarted again last Friday, but the bishops haven't changed at all, despite the presence of a new papal nuncio sent by Pope Francis, presumably specifically to try and get the bishops here to behave. But, well, he's not having much success.
I mean, what we're talking about, just so people understand, the bishops in Nicaragua are siding with the right-wing violence, essentially, and they're calling on people, they basically are calling on the government to surrender the streets to right-wing gangs. The Pope is saying, no, if you're going to be involved, be an honest broker and call for peace on all sides, and they're not doing that. They're very partisan.
No, they're still supporting the right wing, and
right.
so for example, on Friday night there was, after very, very bitter negotiations, the right wing finally agreed to dismantle the roadblocks that are paralyzing the country's economy and have done so
right.
for the last 5 or 6 weeks now, if not for 2 months. But and suddenly the roadblocks have really paralyzed the economy. And one has to remember that all this activity is happening in about 30 municipalities in Nicaragua, mainly along the Pacific coast. So and Nicaragua has 153 municipalities, so you're talking about something like a fifth of the country, but it's a fifth of the country where most of the population lives. And that's why the opposition are focusing on that part of the country.
Right.
But in effect, the opposition terrorist roadblocks, their paramilitary roadblocks, because they're not manned by students. Overseas people probably think, oh, well, the students and the ordinary population are protesting against the government. Well,
no, this is a strategic, surgical operation. This is professional. This is the kind of stuff they design in Langley and Pentagon.
Yeah, Don. It's very well organized, and it's an alliance between organized crime, the Catholic Church hierarchy, and that may sound ridiculous.
Yeah, it's redundant.
On the barricades, on the roadblocks, there's video after video showing priests and pickup trucks flying the yellow and white Catholic Church flag, delivering supplies to armed delinquents, masked delinquents, who are the people that intimidate anybody trying to get through the roadblocks, often charging them money for the right to pass. And it's just, so when I say it's an alliance between organized crime, delinquents, and the Catholic Church, that's no exaggeration. It merely reflects the reality. And also, of course, the right-wing opposition here, the most right-wing parts of the business sector, they're all part of this conspiracy backed by the most extreme right-wing elements in the United States, like Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Ileana Rose Letterman, and that kind of pro-terrorist, anti-Cuban mafia that they represent. Now, there was an interesting recent development that reflected something that also happened in Venezuela, when Bob Corker, who I think is the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Yes, he is, yeah.
He visited Nicaragua and had a meeting, I think. I'm not sure if he met with Daniel Ortega, but he certainly met with senior officials from the Nicaraguan government.
Right.
That opens up another channel of communication for the Nicaraguan government with the U.S. power elite establishment.
Yep, and we're going to have to see where that goes. Maybe pick it up here next week because we're out of time. Tony, thank you very much, we'll be speaking with you again.
Okay, thanks a million, Don.
Thank you.
Take care. Have a good week.
You too. Thanks.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. Both Russia and the U.S. are calling for relations to be rescued, but hostile rhetoric is still growing louder on both sides. Can Moscow and Washington let bygones be bygones? Robert English, former policy analyst at the U.S. Defense Department, international relations scholar, is with me today to talk about this.
The ghost of the Cold War is hovering in Washington and Moscow as relations between Russia and the U.S. deteriorate into a series of personal jabs and escalating decisions. What is inhibiting the understanding between the two great powers? How long will the current confrontation persist, and who will be strong enough to stop it?
Robert English, former policy analyst at the U.S. Defense Department, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you with us.
Happy to be here.
So, interesting times we're living in. I'm going to start off with Henry Kissinger quote. He says that demonization of Vladimir Putin is not a policy. It's an alibi for the absence of one. Do you agree with him?
Yes. Yes.
Is there a coherent policy line on Russia and Washington?
There are 7 or 8 coherent lines, but altogether they produce incoherence. By that I mean the Congress thinks it knows what it's doing. There are some individuals, let's say in the Department of Defense, who have one orientation, in the State Department, which is a revolving door, who have another, and so on. No, a coherent administration line has not emerged because they're fighting internally.
Because Trump started off as a pragmatic Russia campaigner, right? He wanted to make good with Russia, but then the establishment tied his hands. Does this mean that the American line towards Russia is predetermined no matter who the president will be.
No, no, this is unique with Trump. No, tied his hands in particular because they passed this legislation requiring sanctions, right? And that is certainly tied to Trump personally because of the suspicion that he colluded with Russia or that members of his campaign team were up to no good with Russian representatives. And that, who knows, there's this anger because Hillary Clinton lost and blaming it on somebody. There's this sort of outsized anger at Russia. That's why Trump is uniquely tied, but another president might not be.
So you feel like making Russia a U.S. adversary is partially part of the internal political fight in America. They're using Russia adversary against Trump to weaken him. Is that part of the game?
For some, that is. It's not the only thing. One has to admit that Russia hasn't helped in this. There have been Russian actions that have made it easier for the people who dislike Russia, for the Russophobes in Washington, to do what they've done. But yes, it's against Trump. There's suspicion of Russia. There's a whole combination, old Cold Warriors, Trump haters, Hillary supporters, Democrats who just can't necessarily accept a new presidency, people who are genuinely concerned about Russian actions, what happened in England. All these come together to paralyze our Russia policy.
But also, doesn't that come down to strong president, weak president? Because, I mean, I understand you have checks and balances. I understand you can't just do whatever the president wants to do. But when you have a strong president, like, for instance, Reagan, like, he wanted to make good with Soviet Union and everyone followed suit. I feel like maybe if Hillary Clinton were president, if she one day decided that she wanted to make good with Russia, everyone else would agree with her, more or less. And Trump, because he's such an outsider, it seems like he is met with much more resistance.
It's partly that, but the first thing you said is the main thing. A president who comes in, whether it's China, Russia, any foreign policy issue, with a hardline reputation, if they decide then to find accommodation, accord, a treaty, they have a much easier time getting it past the establishment, getting it past Congress. Someone who comes in with a reputation as weak or soft, whether it's China or Russia, whatever it might be, they're constantly met with suspicion and resistance. So Reagan was a tough guy, and then he could make peace. Nixon, Kissinger were hard on Russia. Then they could have detente. You're probably right. Hillary Clinton, who would suspect her of colluding with Russia or making a bad deal? She's as tough as they come on Putin. Trump came in, reputation, not just soft, but super soft. So he's always going to have an uphill battle.
So do you think he's done fixing ties with Russia? Is it like a done battle for him?
You know, sitting in Washington, sitting anywhere in the United States, we don't say anything anymore. We never know never. We never know what's coming next. There's this feeling that this administration has not settled down. Look what's happening with negotiations with North Korea, on, off, on, threats of war, my best friend, trade war with China, trade with Europe. We're going to have an accord. No, we're going to pose massive tariffs.
Iran, yeah.
So Iran, we haven't even got to maybe the most dangerous of all the issues. So I can't answer that. We don't know. We all hope that we find some stability and this administration can focus on one issue or another.
Well, at least unpredictability keeps you guys toned, I give you that much, right? All right, so in the years after the Cold War, the funding cuts meant that fewer and fewer Russian experts were being trained in American schools. What does that mean for Russian knowledge in Washington? How does this influence policy?
It's not a good time for Russia expertise. We have, and it's not just now, but it's the last 20 years, there's a strange combination of lost interest in Russia, so fewer people after the 90s were going into study. Oh, Boris Yeltsin, they have a democracy now. It's kind of dull. It's a crazy place. But perestroika, arms control, Gorbachev, that was exciting. So a lot of people.
What about now? Putin certainly keeps people awake.
So now we do have a renewed interest. But we have problems in our academy, let's say. We train political scientists. We train area experts very poorly. 30 years ago, 20 years ago, when I was in graduate school, We studied history first. We learned the language and the culture very deeply. And only then did we move to politics. And we didn't only stop with politics. We learned some economics. We learned some strategic and military affairs. And our experts were sort of comprehensive. These days, it's much more narrowly focused, and there's much less interest in culture and history and the past. And that produces very narrow or one-sided experts. So even though you're right, we have interests now, people want to work on Russia, they're interested, whether it's to go into intelligence or business or anything in between.
But I feel like even though there are fewer experts, there still are experts. I mean, look at yourself, and there are like a bunch of people of your generation who really do have an in-depth knowledge of Russia, what Russia stands for and what it represents, what it wants. But I feel like the State Department or the White House don't really pay attention to the expert opinion. Do they even take that opinion into consideration when making up policies towards Russia?
So I have great respect for the State Department. There is a large cadre of mid-level officials who have spent their career in Russia, in Prague, maybe in Beijing, back to Russia, developing expertise. They tend to have very balanced and sensible views. But you know what happens every 4 years, or maybe every 8 years. We have an election, and it's the secretary, the deputy secretary, the assistant secretary, the deputy assistants, the political appointees and the ambassadors who come in. And we've got to say, every administration, it's not just Trump, but it was Obama before, and it was Clinton before that. They put in more and more political and unqualified people because they're campaign contributors, because it's politically advantageous, and therefore the competence at the top declines.
Well, the latest Trump advisor in Russia and Europe is Fiona Hill, and she's not like a Putin lover, and it's not like her views towards Russia are super favorable, but she's sensible and she's pragmatic, which is already a very good and rare thing for American establishment.
As an academic colleague, I have great respect for Fiona Hill, for her work. I had her as an invitee to a conference at our university in Los Angeles. She knows the Caucasus as well as Russia, Central Asia. She knows trade and oil and economic issues. And she's balanced, right? She's not an ideologue. She doesn't hate anyone.
But can she have a real impact on the policy? What do you think?
I don't know. I hope that she's working quietly within the system and in tandem, let's say, with people like our new ambassador here in Moscow, John Huntsman, who's also known as a moderate, a sensible person. And don't forget, he has experience in business, international trade. He's been in China and other foreign postings. My hope is that over time, people like Huntsman and Hill will move this administration in a pragmatic direction. But then we watch the revolving door in the White House at the NSC, and I don't know.
So when it comes to Russia and people in Russia, it does seem like the politicians, the public, they have a longer view of relations with the United States. What I mean is that Russia scenario says, we tried to be friends with you guys in the 90s, and then we tried to be friends with you after 9/11, but then the Americans broke their promise, pushed to NATO towards Russia's borders, and then there was Serbia, Iraq, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do the Americans see this decade-old continuity when assessing relations with Russia? Because it does seem to me that the media in America has a much shorter attention span, and so does the public. We see the whole picture. They go by cycle, like political cycle.
You are so right. This is a bigger problem even than you know. The average journalist working in foreign affairs, working on Russia, I have to remind them as preparation for their interview of me what happened 5 years ago. It's as if, not just with every administration, but every turnover of the bureau staff. No, Americans, you know, we tend to approach everything as if we can start from scratch. It's a very endearing and positive characteristics of America, a kind of can-do, overcome the obstacles, don't get stuck in the past. But sometimes we go too far, and there are elements of the past that cannot be ignored. If we want to approach a country, it doesn't just mean Russia. China has historical grievances and issues with its neighbors, with us, with Japan, Korea, Iran, the Shah, 1953, the airliner shoot down. We can't approach any of these countries as if it all started with each new administration. And yet we tend to do that. It's an American weakness. It's also a strength, but mostly a weakness.
But I also feel like Russia equals like the perfect enemy, like the Dr. Evil for America, is a very good narrative for Americans. having Russia as an enemy is much more logical than this undefined terrorism thing. Maybe Russia-US relations are actually victim to a perfect narrative that Russia fits into as a perfect enemy.
There's something very important to what you're saying. I think it works both ways. I think we have this reciprocal U.S. and Russia, and America is a good enemy for Russia. And part of it is, as you say, it's almost psychological. If it wasn't there, you'd have to create it. There's a tendency to find a demon or an adversary, the black and white, the cowboy. But there's also concrete things that each side have done to help fuel that enemy image. But you're right, we are the two biggest powers in the world. Still, China is... I don't want to
super
get into that.
Super ethnocentric, and that doesn't help both of us.
And I don't mean to say the Cold War is back the way it was, let's say, in the 60s, 70s, or up through the 80s. But we stand astride the world, and we have this relationship that eased a bit after the Cold War, but then we both fell back into the old tropes and patterns so easily.
That is exactly what we're going to talk about after the break, so hold your thought there. We'll take a short break right now when we're back with Robert English, former policy analyst at a U.S. Defense Department. We'll discuss more whether U.S.-Russia relations have crossed the point of no return. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Robert English, former policy analyst at the U.S. Defense Department, talking about the current low point in U.S.-Russia relations. Welcome back, Robert. Now, Mitt Romney, when he was running for president, he actually tried to play the Russia foreign policy card in his presidential election, and he was ridiculed by Obama. He was like, oh my God, that is so 80s, bringing Russia back as a foreign policy card. But then, you know, in 2012, the relations between U.S. and Russia started deteriorating slowly, and then in his next State of the Union speech, he was talking about Russia. And then, you know, the second thing we know that the Pentagon says that Russia is the biggest threat for America. So maybe actually Romney was ahead of his time. And why? Why? Why did this card play out so well now, but it didn't then for him?
Well, what you're really asking is what's gone wrong with our relations, since the answer is that relations have deteriorated. Both sides bear blame for that. And suddenly Romney's seems prescient, seems farsighted. Although, what I think he said something like the greatest geopolitical threat. Even in the Pentagon, I don't care what they put in that report. I talk to Defense Department people, Navy people all the time. They're looking at China, right? Sometimes those documents or those pronouncements have a budget purpose in mind. They want to get a new weapon system. They're sort of tacking to the political wind to appeal to some senator or some district. But on the whole, our military establishment, they know that China
is the biggest threat.
But it's also convenient to say Russia's doing this in the Arctic, Russia's doing this in the Mediterranean, because it helps get the appropriations.
It's the perfect narrative, I'm telling you, because you're not going to upset China and American ties to China, economic ties, or you can always blame everything on Russia, and, you know, people love it. They go with it, they roll with it. It's like the old Cold War paradigm.
Well, let me tell you something. But this is interesting, because you've pointed out that I used to work in the Department of Defense, and my research, I'm a university professor now, but my research, especially recently on the Arctic, keeps me in contact with people who are in or around the defense establishment. And when I ask about what's happening in the Arctic, why are some people sounding the alarm? My interpretation of Russia's new bases and new capabilities is a very sensible thing. Russia should be doing this. The trade, the environmental issues, navigation, safety, search and rescue. Why is there this drumbeat of threat? And they say to me, we know it's not true. That's political. We actually think that Russia's doing sensible things in the Arctic. We have managed to cooperate for almost 20 years since the creation of the Arctic Council. In fact, it's more than 20 years. But we know that our secretaries at the top like to go to Congress and say, woo, and get the money for new weapons.
Okay, so then there is the Pentagon people, the well-researched people who actually know and see behind the narrative that's popular. But then there's the narrative and American people assessing whatever it is that they hear and see on the TV. So when When you do things, right, or when others do things, you usually imagine yourself doing it. Like, you imagine, like, this is what you do, so no. That's why the others do it. For instance, I'm sure, like, for Americans, Russia Crimea or Russia Syria is the same thing as Americans going to Libya or Iraq or Afghanistan, for that matter. But really, it's so much different because Russia Crimea is like United States and Florida, and Russia Syria is actually really handling immediate threats of homegrown terrorism, extremism right next to your border. Yeah. It's not war over the ocean for us, you know. Every war for Americans is war over the ocean that has nothing to do with proximity of your borders. So do you feel like Americans, they actually see these when assessing Russia's actions?
No.
How different that's American actions are from Russian actions?
Whether it goes all the way back to the Second World War and the feeling of vulnerability, the repeated invasions from Germany, from the West, and the need that Stalin felt to create a kind of buffer zone of allied countries, all the way to the present, and what happens in Chechnya, what happens in Syria and Afghanistan, how close those terrorist threats are to Russia. Americans have never fully appreciated the geographic vulnerability that Russia's geography condemns it to. They have a general idea that we're a great power, we mess around in the world, Russia's a great power, they mess around, we usually do good things, we're not so sure about them. There is a kind of sense of equilibrium, but definitely it doesn't sufficiently take into account the vulnerability of being in Central Eurasia.
So you've said that there's a minority among U.S. politicians who believe that Putin isn't after upsetting the world order, but he's actually defending Russia's interests. So can there be a non-hawkish view on Russia in today's United States, or that would immediately be labeled as a pro-Kremlin, pro-KGB-sponsored propaganda?
It might not be quite that extreme, but look, I have colleagues. I consider myself a balanced person with a lot of experience. I was with Ambassador Matlock, our former ambassador. I would consider him in that league.
Blacklisting him now in America.
And exactly. You know, it's dangerous to be too sympathetic to Russia, even when you have a good argument and can back it with facts. The atmosphere right now is so Russophobic that people are trimming their sails. I won't say it's a McCarthyist atmosphere, but it's a very toxic one. I do think, however, and Matlock made this point, and he's seen it all, and he saw Reagan and Gorbachev come and make peace, that it will take, on both sides, dynamic leadership to break that. An ordinary person, a Fiona Hill, right, in the NSC, a Robert English at my university, somebody else maybe in the White House, probably would be pilloried as being too soft, being an apologist. But someone really strong in the White House and respected, I don't know if that's probably not Bernie Sanders. I don't know if that's Joe Biden. He's very anti-Russian. I don't know who the candidate on the horizon is, but I can imagine an American president saying, enough, we have bigger problems and we have common problems.
He tried to do that when he came, but look what happened. I mean,
the current president is not the best messenger of a coherent policy. Yeah, on Russia, he had a good core idea. I even wrote that there's nothing wrong. You know, why was he pilloried for saying, let's try to get along with Russia. It's in the best interest of both countries and the world. Who can disagree with that?
Do you think Do you think if he somehow, in a weird, strange way, manages to make peace with North Korea, then he would be like this?
A major foreign policy breakthrough.
And then they would cut him a slack for Russia?
Especially if it goes against all the things the experts predicted and he still pulls it off. Could do that. That could buy him some credibility, and he could say, you guys all told me I didn't know what I was doing, and look what I did. I accomplished something that Obama couldn't and Bush couldn't. I'm not sure that's going to happen, but were it to happen, it would definitely change his stature as a foreign policy leader, as an original break-the-mold kind of thinker. I wish that could happen. I'm not holding my breath, but it would be incredible.
All right, so the main point between U.S. and Russia right now is that since the mid-2000s, Putin has been very clear that the current post-Cold War order is not reflecting of the world reality anymore, that the liberal Western-led end of history didn't happen, that Russia wants to sit at a table an equal say when it comes to deciding matters of the world, and especially when it comes to Putin's backyard, I mean the post-Soviet area. Why don't the Americans take this point seriously?
no disrespect, but we're asking the same question again. What's gone wrong? Because the premise of your question is, isn't this reasonable? Why can't it work as a policy, as a basis for accommodation between the two countries? The answer is Russia and Putin have been so demonized, and again, not without having helped some of that along themselves, and our political establishment so quickly slid back into the Cold War.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but like, to be fair, okay, to be fair, everything that Russia has done from the 2000s regarding the West has been a defensive action rather than offensive. Everything that West doesn't like right now in terms of Russia, whether it's Crimea or whether it's Ukraine, it's a defensive action. It's a reaction rather than anything else.
I am sympathetic to what you're saying about Russia defending its legitimate national interests. And if the shoe were on the other foot, Americans would understand how sensitive Crimea is, both strategically and historically. I guess what I'm saying is that the leadership on the two sides have almost stopped caring. I mean the previous leadership. I mean the Obama, Clinton, and President Putin himself. They seem to have given up on each other. And so when certain moves are made, they almost seem to be done to give maximum offense and continue fueling that. I can imagine, well, I don't know, I wasn't there, but I can imagine a Russia defending its national interests in a way that doesn't help the hawks in the United States. But Putin has this image of such a hard guy. And I don't blame him for not caring about American public opinion anymore, because it seems like no matter what he does, there's an unfair response. Nonetheless, what I'm saying is it's gotten very personal. And you're right. I was aghast when not only Obama, but Secretary Clinton, that we had our national leaders who had descended to comparing President Putin to Saddam Hussein or Adolf Hitler. So even in the worst days of the Cold War, there were certain lines we didn't cross in personalizing our
frictions.
There was a
culture of discourse definitely there.
And there was some respect and just recognition that that's just going to take us down a spiral unnecessarily. So when I say that I see the training of our experts, our foreign policy culture in the U.S., as having, you know, gone a huge step back from the old days of the wise man, of the Kissingers and so forth. This is what I mean. This was inconceivable before. And this, and it happens on both sides, the demonization. It's not just the Americans demonizing, although I'm an American, so I was very critical of our side in that. But it's unnecessarily exacerbated, personalizing our differences, makes it so much harder later to come to the table and rebuild something. It's got so personally nasty.
Well, let's hope there's still some hope there, because when people like you come here and then they go back and say what they really see and whatever really is happening in Russia, I still think that it helps little by little, but that's how the world changes.
Could it be that we need a common enemy again? I don't mean another Nazi Germany. It could be some climactic disaster. It could be something in the Pacific.
I think we should just start to respect each other's worldviews and realize that
of course we should.
Things are done differently in different parts of the world, and there's not just one America. They're like, how many billion people live in the world, or just one Russia?
We need people to become see a things lot more mature and sensible, no doubt.
Thank you so much for this wonderful talk, for this interview. Have a really nice rest of this day. Hope we'll meet again soon.
We will.
Talking to Robert English, scholar of international relations, former policy analyst at the U.S. Defense Department, discussing what are the prospects of U.S.-Russia ties going back to normal. And that's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I'll see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.